Forever Girl, a Hamilton Spectator serial podcast. This is part two. I'm John Wells. In the summer of 1974, this was the description on a reward poster seeking information about missing 4-year-old Cindy Williams. Quote, female, 3 feet 8 inches tall, 40 pounds, hazel eyes, blonde hair and a short shag cut, has a full set of teeth with a visible filling on the upper right front, dark tan, wart on the third toe of the left foot, last seen wearing navy blue shorts, navy blue tank top, and white running shoes. What is it about that thumbnail description that tweaks the heart? In part, I think, it's the dimensions listed that make no sense in the context of a violent crime. 40 pounds, 3 feet, 8 inches. And then also the subtle references to the carefree and simple life of a child, which is what her life was supposed to be. A tan, the tank top, the shag haircut, the wart. What kind of sick and evil person could even look the wrong way at a child, much less take her away? Diane Williams, Cindy's mother, was quoted in the Spectator at the time. Quote, if only whoever has Cindy would phone and say, I have your girl, and just tell me what I had to do to get her back. That's all I want. I would like to say to whoever has her, just call anyone in the phone book and tell them where you'll be leaving Cindy, and we will come and pick her up. Unquote. The investigation into her disappearance stretched from late summer into the fall and then the winter of 1975. What had happened to her? No one would ever know for certain. Had Cindy been snatched from inside the apartment building at 1165 Fennel Avenue East near Upper Ottawa Street when she got in by herself upstairs to visit her friend? Or had Cindy, who had a hard time following rules, upon discovering her playmate wasn't home when she knocked on the door, taken that opportunity to go outside and play in the swings on the playground behind the building, rather than go back to her apartment unit and been abducted at that point? A little boy told police he saw Cindy outside, walking away with a man wearing a dark hat, briefly west along Fennel, and then got into a dark car. Kathy Horvath, Cindy's aunt, was just 13 back then, but remembers John Cherwadi, Diane's partner, and Cindy's adopted father, coming to their home to tell them the awful news. John styled himself as a tough guy, in part perhaps by necessity, but more on that in a moment. Kathy remembers him at the door, crying and shaking and saying over and over, someone has taken Cindy. John Cherwadi had been employed at Burlington Steel for several months. After Cindy went missing, he got a cash advance at work so he could put up his own $1,500 for a reward leading to her return. Cindy had never known her birth father, who had left for the East Coast soon after she was born. John was the only dad she ever knew. He was a doting father, but on the other hand, some wondered if his lifestyle was the reason she had been taken. I wanted to learn more about John Cherwadi. His father died in the Second World War, and his adoptive father was a bookie in Hamilton. When John Cherwadi was 13, he ran crap games downtown, and as an adult, John did 1 year less a day in jail for possession of stolen property. He had 5 kids with his first wife, but wasn't home much, and usually had women on the side. In the 1960s, after he was released from prison, he regularly hosted illegal floating poker games in Hamilton. I chatted with Mike Cherwadi, John's son.
My dad was a player. Like a huge player, like, you know what? He was a gorgeous man, kind of looked like Roger Moore. He had a lavish, fun lifestyle. He everyone wanted to be around him. Even when he was with my mom, he had 3 or 4 girlfriends on the side, and Diane happened to be one of them.
Right.
And then when my mom was separated, when they split, it wasn't a nice split at first, and then. But like I said, in the long run, it all worked out. But even when my dad was with Diane, he still was quite a player. He had quite a life. He was fun to be around. He was, like, really, really exciting to be around.
Mike loved his dad dearly, but said that his father's shady line of work also made him a marked man. But could that have been connected to the abduction of a little girl?
My dad was a badass. He had 2 bodyguards. He, you know, she could follow around. One was his best friend, but when he needed help, his best friend's brother, Alec, was, you know, Bronco was 6'6", 280, or, 280, and his brother, Alec, was 6'8", 320.
Those were his bodyguards?
Bodyguard friends, yeah. So, it's a weird life, eh? When you do stuff like that, and you either make out good or you don't make out good, and bookies sometimes, you know, when things go bad or something goes bad, you have to come up with a lot of money, and,
So he was bookie for the races, like
for everything. You could bet anything, football, baseball, anything you want. Yeah. When I was 16 years old, I used to take it up in this 1977 brand new Monte Carlo, and I would drive around and pick up his runs for him because I knew everyone sold. There was a theory with Sydney, like, you know, maybe my dad screwed somebody around really bad, and half the city of Hamilton loved him and half hated him, right? So they didn't really know what it was.
Diane, Cindy's mother, preferred to see the best in John Trewaddy. Friends tried to keep her in the dark about some of his dealings and infidelity, but I wondered if Diane had also perhaps willfully turned a blind eye, seeing him at worst as a lovable rogue. Because the fact was, not only was he good to Cindy and Cindy's older sister Michelle, he was also more loving and accepting of Diane than her own parents had been. They ostracized her for years in the name of their Jehovah Witness beliefs. As odd as it might sound, 3 months after Cindy went missing, Diane and John married in November. A psychologist has suggested it would be a good idea for them as a kind of therapy. John had returned to work to help cope, but Diane was hospitalized for depression. When she was home, she chain-smoked relentlessly. Maybe a wedding wasn't such a bad idea. December came and went, and January, February, March, still nothing about Cindy. And then, in April, a discovery about 7 kilometers south of Fennel Avenue East, where Cindy had been taken. Back then, the area south of Rymal Road was outside city limits, part of Glanbrook Township. Near where Glover Road meets 20 Road was farmland and woods and marsh and a narrow dirt laneway. It was a place where some went to park, drink, and dump stuff. And then, too, along Glover Road, which was a gravel road back then, several houses had been built. One of the families who lived there was named Pozanski. Wednesday, April 30th, 1975, the morning broke foggy and a smoky haze seemed to linger all day long. That day, a man named Kim Pozanski was visiting his parents at their house on Glover. He left the house with his 2 young daughters for a quick drive up the gravel road, where they parked and went for a little walk in the field and brush so Kim could dig up some peat moss for a terrarium he was making for his wife. As he dug in one spot, he saw what looked like an inverted bowl sticking through the dirt. He thought it might be bones from an animal. He had seen them before in that area over the years. He refused to believe his instinct, that it was a human skull, a small one. He tapped a shovel on top of it. He cleared away more dirt. One of his daughters called over to him. She held up a small pair of shorts. The other daughter found a running shoe. Kim Pozanski felt sick to his stomach. In a panic, he bagged some of the material and drove back to the house. His father, who was from the Ukraine, mistrusted authority and told his son to return it and say nothing more about it, or else he would be blamed for whatever had happened. But Kim Pozanski called police. The remains were sent to the Center of Forensic Sciences in Toronto, which back then had existed by that name just 9 years. There was no such thing as DNA testing. They used dental records to confirm that the remains, in fact, belonged to Cindy Williams. Police did not have advanced forensic techniques commonly used today that can recreate crime scenes and track suspects. But there was one pattern to the evidence that was disturbingly apparent to the naked eye. The bones had been found separated from the clothes. That pointed to the worst conclusion of all, that the victim had been sexually assaulted before she was killed. The day of the discovery of the remains, family and friends came around the Pozanski house. That included Kim's teenage cousin, Dan Dobrzynski, who also lived on Glover. For the story, I had wanted to find and talk to Kim Pozanski, get him to show me where he made his discovery, but I learned that he had died a few years ago. But there was an old Spectator article about the discovery of the skeleton that quoted Dan Dobrzynski. I looked Dan up. He was still around and living on the mountain. I picked him up in my car and we went for a ride out to Glover Road. He talked about that day in the spring of 1975.
So did you see Kim that day? The day?
Oh yeah, like we were talking to him that day.
Yeah. He came back to the house and...
Yeah, well, he showed us.
He showed you the stuff?
He showed us the stuff.
What did he have with him?
Well, he had the skull, he had the shorts. And yeah.
Oh, all of it then, right? So he had like in a just
in a bag.
In a bag,
yeah.
Like a plastic bag or something.
Yeah.
Was he kind of freaked out?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, his dad wasn't the one to talk to. I mean, like he didn't like the police either.
Right.
You're right about that.
Yeah.
I drove with Dan past the tiny 600 square foot house where he used to live, and Kim's parents' place as well. We parked on Glover, where it meets 20 Road. This was the place, Dan said. Back then, it was some woods, marsh. This is where she was found, he said. He was positive.
He was upset, obviously.
Oh, geez, yeah. Big time.
Yeah.
Especially, he's got little kids, too. Right?
Yeah.
Well, he had Billy and Michelle were around the same age. Weren't too far off that.
Yeah, he had them with him when they...
When they discovered it. But back then, it was like an everyday thing, traveling, going through that woods. Like, it was one of those things. And I used to catch chickens down the road, too.
Really?
At the Altman's farm, eh? Mm-hmm. So... chicken catching was to do it in the middle of the night, right? So the thing was to walk by that woods going home after this was done, found, eh?
Right.
You know, it's a little bit scary going by there all the time then after that, eh? Because the flashbacks, eh? Like,
yeah.
Okay, this guy's running around and, you know, I think it was a scary time.
And that was
you didn't expect anything like that to ever happen.
Today there is a factory here as well, but also a big field and a few trees near the place. The spot is still undeveloped, no doubt transformed by the elements, and trees have been cleared away, but this is where her life likely ended before the killer dug a shallow grave. Dan was a helpful and genial man, and as we drove, he spoke about life out in the country back then, about how his parents were given a parcel of land to build on by his grandparents as a wedding gift, because his grandfather owned some farmland. I enjoyed listening to him. At one point, he simply said wistfully, "Memories." It was as though we were both putting aside the terrible reason we'd come together here, now, at this spot.
So this is my cousin Kim's place right here. You can't see that's where you live right here.
The White House?
Yeah.
The first White House?
Yeah. That's Kim.
Yeah, well,
right there. That was his place.
Yeah.
Mom and Dad's place there.
This is Kim's, and then Zier.
That was Dawson's, that was Molitor's. My dad's place is right here.
Dawson, Molitor.
My dad's place is right here.
Right here, the yellow.
Yeah, but all that wasn't there. That was a field, eh? That house is still the same house.
That's tiny, eh?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we were there. The garage is still there. Everything's there, like, you know. But we used to have, like, he used to have cow shed, chicken shed. He used to be a wholly different setup of property, eh?
He had chickens and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah. We had two steers. We had a milking cow.
Right. What did he do for a living?
He worked at Stelco.
That's right. Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah, Stelco. Now it's Glover's.
That's Glover's place there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is all built up here. This is where Davison used to live right here. This is Kenny Davison. Davison's here, lived here.
The White House?
Yep.
Yeah.
And Drinkwater's lived there.
Drinkwater's there. Yes.
But Davison's, his mother and father were, well, he was a square dance caller.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That was his job.
Johnny Davison, yeah.
Interesting.
The discovery of the remains turned the missing persons investigation that had begun the day Cindy went missing 8 months earlier into a homicide investigation. Hamilton Spectator headline, "Police Hunt for Cindy's Killer." Since the remains were found in Glanbrook Township, the OPP was in charge of the homicide case. The lead OPP investigator was a detective named William O'Rourke, and he had assistance from Hamilton Police, primarily an officer named Bud Black, who would not let the case go, and never did, not for years after the trail had gone stone cold. But the hunt was mostly reviewing information police had gathered 8 months earlier and re-interviewing people of interest, For Diane Williams, whose name was now Diane Chiwadi, the discovery meant closure of a sort. Her daughter had been found. She knew that Cindy was no longer suffering, but she also knew for certain she was gone, and Diane would spend the rest of her life tormented for feeling responsible and not knowing who the killer was. The case was looked at again by the OPP in 1991 and 2000, but it's unclear how vigorously it was examined. Diane told Kathy that an OPP officer had contacted her at one point, but only that once. Diane saw TV programs about cold cases getting solved and wondered, why not Cindy's? I spoke with a retired OPP officer who was among those who revisited the case years ago, but he could not remember anything about it, not even if he had ever met Diane in person or not. Over the years, Diane would not talk about Cindy much, although on occasion she opened up with Kathy or longtime friend Cynthia. Cynthia says that the ghosts came out sometimes when Diane was sleeping.
She had a tough time. Diane had a tough time right till the day she died.
Yeah. I remember one occasion she was going out with one guy. Later on, maybe 10 years before she died, like before Diane died, mm-hmm. that she was at her home and she had a male friend there. And Diane went to lay down, and this one time, I don't even know if you know the story, she's in her bedroom and she's going like this on the walls. Put your hand out, I'll get you, put your hand out. She was screaming, Cindy, Cindy, put your hand out, put your hand out.
She had a nightmare or something like that?
Yeah, like a nightmare. And the guy, her friend that was there, called me because thought she was talking about me.
Yeah.
So I come running over and here it was, she was talking about Cindy.
Oh, really?
But little things like that would happen with her.
Life moved on. Diane and John raised their one daughter, Michelle, hovering over her, overprotective. Michelle was the first person I tried to contact for the story many months earlier, when she had not seemed up for talking about it. Michelle had tried to block it all out when she was a child, I had been told. Maybe, I thought, she's still trying to block it out. And who could blame her? But when I called Michelle on February 3rd and asked if I could come and meet her, she said yes. 5 days later, Kathy Horvath sent me an email to update her quest with the OPP to re-examine the case. I had thought the OPP would simply tell her they would see what they could do and send her on her way. But then I also knew that Kathy didn't seem like the type to accept an ambiguous answer. She told me she had, in fact, just met face-to-face with a detective named Matt Watson. She said Watson told her he has a young daughter, and that he found Cindy's case disturbing. He told her he would look at the evidence box in storage. And he said he wanted to meet with me as well.